Galilee into the Ginnesar Valley, past Arbel and the horns of Hattin, on the plains where Saladin the Kurd had once crushed the Crusaders in mortal combat. But as they trudged on, even Yossi became dismayed. Their promised land was not a land flowing with milk and honey, but a land of festering, stagnated swamps and eroded hills and rock-filled fields and unfertile earth caused by 1,000 years of Arab and Turkish neglect. It was a land denuded of its richness. It was a land that lay bleeding and fallow. After a while they came to Mount Tabor in the center of the Galilee and climbed up this hill which had played such a great part in the history of their people. It was here that the Jewish Joan of Arc, Deborah, and her general Barak hid with their armies and swooped down to crush the invading host. Atop Tabor, they could see for miles in every direction. Around them stood Crusader ruins and a tiny monastery. It was here that Jesus was transfigured and held communion with Moses and Elijah. From Tabor, they could see the entire sorrowful picture. A fruitless, listless, dying land. And they trudged on with heavy hearts. The seeds of the past were all around them. They passed Mount Gilboa, where Saul and Jonathan fell in battle, and where Gideon lies. And they passed Bethel and Jericho. As they moved into the hills of Judea, their spirits rose again. The ancient terraces still stood from the time when hundreds of thousands of Jews took richness from the earth. There was no richness left. The hills were eroded, but the elation of the Rabinsky brothers could not be dimmed as they ascended higher and higher and higher. Arriving at the peak of the ridges, Yossi and Yaakov saw the city of David, Jerusalem. Heart of their hearts, dream of their dreams. In that second, all the years of privation and all the bitterness and suffering were erased. They entered the old walled city through the Damascus Gate and wended their way through the narrow streets and bazaars to the mighty Hurva Synagogue.
"If only Father were with us now," Yossi whispered. "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem,"
Yaakov prayed the lament of the captives. From the synagogue they went to the one remaining wall of their great ancient temple. It stood on the site of the Mosque of Omar, the Dome of the Rock. This wall was the holiest place in all Jewry. When at last they sought hospitality from the Jews, they lost their illusions. The Jews in Jerusalem were Hasidim, ultra-Orthodox fanatics whose interpretations of the laws were so strict they could be lived up to only by complete withdrawal from the civilized world. Even in the Pale, these groups had separated themselves from the rest of the ghetto. For the first time since they left Chitomir, Yossi and Yaakov were refused the hospitality of a Jewish home. The Jerusalem Jews did not like the Belus, and the lovers of Zion were berated for their ungodlike ideas. The boys then saw themselves as intruders in their own land. They walked away from Jerusalem, shrouded in sadness, down from the hills of Judea, toward the port of Jaffa. This ancient port, which had been in constant use since Phoenician times, was another version of Beirut, Aleppo, or Tripoli. Narrow alleys, filth, degradation. However, there were a few Jewish settlements nearby, at Rishon LeZion, Rehovot, and Petach Tikva. In Jaffa itself, there was some Jewish commerce as well as an agency for Jewish immigrants. Here they learned the full story. There were but 5,000 Jews in the entire Palestine province of the Ottoman Empire. Most of these were ancients who lived in study and prayer in the four holy cities of Tzfat, Jerusalem, Hebron, and Tiberias. The dozen or so agricultural colonies established by Jews were all in dire straits. They were kept going through the philanthropy of wealthy European Jews, the barons de Hirsch, Rothschild, and the Swiss multimillionaire de Schumann. Much of the idealism of the Belus had disappeared. It was one thing to speak of rebuilding the house of Jacob from a cellar in the Pale. It was another to face the realities of the hardships and the complete disintegration that had befallen Palestine. The Belus were all inexperienced in agriculture. The philanthropists sent over experts to help them. But it was a matter of using cheap Arab labor and settling on two or three crops for export, olives, grapes, and citrus. No attempt at self-labor had been tried, nor were there attempts to balance the agriculture. The Jews, in fact, had become overseers. Both the Arabs and the ruling Turks stole from the Jews mercilessly. Crops were taxed to the limit. There were all sorts of restrictive stumbling blocks. The roving bands of Bedouins looked upon the Jews as children of death because of their refusal to defend themselves. There were, however, a few hundred Jewish boys like the Rabinsky brothers who stayed around Jaffa, and these kept the spark of the Belu movement alive. They talked night after night in the Arab cafes. The task of regenerating this miserable land seemed nearly impossible, but it could be done if there were only more Jews with a fighting spirit. Yossi reckoned that more Jews had to come to Palestine sooner or later, for there were bound to be more and worse pogroms in Russia, and the entire Pale was stirring. Everyone recognized that something was missing that was not in the Talmud, or the Torah, or the Midrash, or the Mishnah. Most of the boys, like Yaakov and Yossi, had escaped from Russian military service or had fled out of misery or poverty or some idealistic hopes. The Jews already in Palestine treated them as outsiders. Further, they were stateless wanderers. It took a year for an answer to come back from Rabbi Lipzin. They learned that their mother had died of incurable and bottomless grief. For the next 4 or 5 years, Yaakov and Yossi grew to manhood. They worked around the docks in Jaffa and in the fields of the Jewish settlements, either as laborers or overseers. When the Jews began moving out of the old walled city in Jerusalem with the aid of the British Jewish philanthropist Moses Montefiore, they worked as stonemasons. Everything in Jerusalem was being built of that hauntingly beautiful limestone quarried from the hills of Judea. They lived from job to job. Little by little, they lost contact with their deep religious training, which had been the dominating force of ghetto life. Only on the high holy days did they travel to Jerusalem. Only on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, did they search their souls and their lives. And, too, on the Day of Judgment, Rosh Hashanah, the New Year. Yaakov and Yossi Rabinsky became typical of a new type of Jew. They were young and strong, and they were free men tasting of a freedom they had never known in the Pale. Yet they longed for a purpose, and they longed for contact with the Jews of Europe. The years 1891, 1892, and 1893 came and went. A few more settlers straggled in to burden the pocketbooks of the philanthropists. But as Yaakov and Yossi lived in apparent aimlessness in Palestine, dramatic events were taking place in another part of the world which were to shape their destiny and the destiny of every Jew for all time. Chapter 6. France, 1894 to 97. The Jews of France and of most of Western Europe were better off than the Jews of Eastern Europe. After the massacres and expulsions of the Middle Ages, the vicious side of Jew-hating abated in both France and England. A great day came for the Jews with the French Revolution. After 1,500 years, there was at last a country in Europe which accepted them as equal human beings. France was the first country in Europe to grant Jews the full rights of citizenship without qualification. Their position was further enhanced by Napoleon, according to whom Judaism was a religion, not a nationality. So long as French Jews regarded it only as a religion and gave their loyalty to France, They ought to be granted full and equal status. The early 1800s were the beginning of a golden era for the Jews of France. The Jewish community produced a host of brilliant doctors, lawyers, scientists, poets, writers, musicians, and statesmen who seemed to justify the Napoleonic concept of assimilation. There were discrete forms of anti-Semitism in France, of course, but the unpleasantnesses associated with being Jewish were at a minimum there. Never before had Jews in Europe known such freedom or held such a position in society. By the middle of the 1800s, they were well integrated into all walks of French life and had formed the powerful Universal Alliance as their voice and philanthropic arm. Jew-hating is an incurable disease. Under certain democratic conditions, it may not flourish well. Under other conditions, the germ may even appear to die. But it never does die, even in the most ideal climate. In France, there lived a young career army captain. He came from a well-to-do family. In the year 1893, he was hauled into a military court on trumped-up charges of selling secrets to the Germans. The trial of this man shook the world and became an irremediable blotch on the cause of French justice. The man was found guilty of treason and sentenced to life on Devil's Island. His name was Alfred Dreyfus. In the bitter winter of 1894, Alfred Dreyfus stood in disgrace in a courtyard. In a ceremony of public ostracism, the epaulets were cut from his shoulders, his cheeks were slapped, his sword broken, and the buttons pulled from his cloak. He was denounced above an ominous drum roll as a traitor to France. As he was taken off to begin life in a penal hell, he cried, "I am innocent! Long live France!" Alfred Dreyfus was a Jew. The dormant disease of anti-Semitism erupted in France. Goaded on by Edouard Drumont, the arch-Jew-hater, mobs of Frenchmen ran through the streets of Paris, screaming the age-old cry, "Death to the Jews!" In later years, the great novelist Émile Zola took up the case of Dreyfus. In an open letter to the President of France, he branded the horrible miscarriage of justice in immortal prose. A certain man witnessed Dreyfus's hour of disgrace in the Paris courtyard. Although Dreyfus was freed, this man could not forget the cry, "I am innocent!" Moreover, he could not forget the Parisian mob screaming, "Death to the Jews!" It haunted him day and night. The man who could not forget was Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl was also a Jew. He was born in Hungary, but his well-to-do family moved to Austria, and he grew up in Vienna. His training in formal Judaism was superficial. He and his family firmly believed in the prevalent theories of assimilation. Herzl was a brilliant essayist, playwright, journalist. Like so many creative men of his school, he was hounded by an incessant restlessness. He was married to a good woman, but one completely incapable of giving him the compassion and understanding he needed. Fortunately for Herzl, his restless ventures were well financed by a generous family allowance. Herzl drifted to Paris and eventually became Paris correspondent for the powerful Viennese New Free Press. He was relatively happy. Paris was a carefree city, and his job was good, and there was always that wonderful intellectual exchange. What had brought him to Paris, really? What unseen hand guided him into that courtyard on that winter's day? Why Herzl? He did not live or think as a devout Jew, yet when he heard the mobs beyond the wall shout, "Death to the Jews!" his life and the life of every Jew was changed forever. Theodor Herzl pondered and thought, and he decided that the curse of anti-Semitism could never be eradicated. So long as one Jew lived, there would be someone to hate him. From the depths of his troubled mind, Herzl wondered what the solution could be, and he came to a conclusion. the same conclusion that 1 million Jews in 100 lands had come to before him. The same conclusion that Pinsker had written about in his pamphlet about auto-emancipation. Herzl reasoned that only if the Jews established themselves again as a nation would all Jews of all lands finally exist as free men. They had to have a universal spokesman. They had to command respect and dignity as equals through a recognized government. The paper in which he set down these ideas was called The Jewish State. Galvanized into action by this sudden calling, Herzl drove himself unmercifully to gather support for his ideas. He went to those enormously wealthy philanthropists who were supporting the colonies of Jews in Palestine. They ridiculed the Jewish state idea as nonsense. Charity was one thing, as Jews they gave to less fortunate Jews, but talk of rebuilding a nation was madness. But the Jewish state idea caught on and spread through 100 lands. Herzl's idea was neither novel nor unique, but his dynamic drive would not let it die. Important support began to gather around him. Max Nordau, a transplanted Hungarian in Paris with an international reputation as a writer, rallied his support, as did Wolfson in Germany and de Haas in England. Many Christians in high places also expressed their approval of the idea. In the year 1897, a convention of leading Jews throughout the world was called in the town of Basel, Switzerland. It was indeed a parliament of world Jewry. Nothing like it had happened since the Second Temple had been destroyed. Assimilationists were there, and lovers of Zion were there. Orthodox Jews were there, and socialists were there. No matter what their leanings, they all had a common bond, and to a man they were prepared to stage a rebellion against 2,000 years of unspeakable persecution. The Basel Convention called for a return of Jews to their ancient historic homeland, for only through the establishment of a Jewish state could all Jews of all lands achieve freedom. They called the movement Zionism. As blood riots against the Jews were increasing in Russia, Poland, Romania, Austria, and Germany, and as Jew-baiting was reborn in France, the Basel Convention made its historic proclamation. The aim of Zionism is to create a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, secured by public law. Theodor Herzl wrote in his diary, "In Basel, I established a Jewish state. If I were to say that aloud today, universal laughter would be the response. Maybe in 5 years, certainly in 50, everybody will recognize it." After the formal declaration of Zionism, Theodor Herzl plunged into the arduous work like a man possessed. He was a dynamic leader and inspired all those around him. He consolidated his support, gained new adherents, raised funds, and built an organization. Herzl's immediate objective, however, was to obtain a charter or some other legal basis upon which Zionism could be built. There was a split within Jewry itself. Herzl was constantly harassed by an element which considered his political Zionism impure. Many of the old lovers of Zion balked. A part of the religious element decried him as a false messiah, just as another segment had praised him as the true messiah. But the Herzl train would not and could not be derailed. Hundreds of thousands of Jews carried an imprinted shekel in their pockets as proof of membership. Still without a charter, Herzl began visiting heads of state to obtain a hearing for his ideas. Herzl worked beyond his capacities. He depleted his personal finances, neglected his family, and impaired his health. Zionism had become a great obsession with him. At last he obtained an interview with the Sultan of the crumbling Ottoman Empire, Abdul Hamid II, Abdul the Damned. The aging old despot fenced with Herzl and gave half promises to consider a charter for Palestine in exchange for desperately needed money. Abdul was a corrupt human being. His vast holdings in the Middle East ran from the Mesopotamian province and included Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and much of the Arabian Peninsula. He tried to play the Zionist proposal off against better gains and finally refused Herzl's appeal. It was a terrible setback. In the year 1903, matters reached a new low in Russia. In the city of Kishinev, the Jews were charged once again with using Christian blood for their rituals. And on Easter of that year, the government secretly spurred on a wanton slaughter that left the ghetto of Kishinev in ruins. Finally, England lent a sympathetic ear. At the turn of the century, the British were expanding their influence in the Middle East and were already becoming a challenge to the failing Ottomans. They were entrenched in Egypt as well as in half a dozen sheikhdoms on the Arab Peninsula, and they were anxious to gain the favor of world Jewry in order to further their own aspirations. They offered the Zionists a part of the Sinai Peninsula for Jewish immigration and colonization. It was the understanding that this area stood at the door of the Promised Land, and the door would open when the British took over. The plan was vague and ill-advised, and Herzl still hoped to gain a charter for Palestine. So the plan collapsed. More attempts to gain a charter failed. The pogroms were overrunning a great part of Europe. Herzl became certain that a temporary haven had to be obtained to ease the situation. The British came forth with a second proposal. They offered the African territory of Uganda to the Zionists for Jewish colonization. Herzl desperately agreed to take it up before the next convention. When the Uganda plan was proposed by Herzl, a fierce opposition developed, led by the Russian Zionists. The basis of their resistance was the fact that they could find no mention of Uganda in the Bible. 25 solid years of pogroms in Russia and in Poland were now causing the Jews to pour out from Eastern Europe by the thousands. By the turn of the century, 50,000 had found their way to Palestine. Abdul Hamid II saw this influx of Jews as potential allies of the British and decreed that no more Jews from Russia, Poland, or Austria would be allowed. However, the Sultan's empire was rotten to the core. The Zionists had a world headquarters in England and a growing bank to back them up. Zionist bribe money kept the door of Palestine open for all who would enter. This was the first Aliyah of the Jewish exodus. Along with the return of the exiles to their promised land, another event was taking place in the Arab world. After centuries of subjugation, there was a rankling of unrest among the Arabs that spelled the beginnings of Arab nationalism. In all the Arab world, there existed not a single independent or autonomous state. Arab nationalism sprang first from liberal elements in Lebanon as a progressive movement bent on instituting long overdue reforms. The ideas grew until a first conference was held in Paris and the call was given for the sleepers to awake. These ideas not only frightened the colonials, but they frightened the oppressors within the Arab world, and the well-meaning movement was grabbed up by tribal leaders, sheikhs, religious leaders, and effendi landowners under whose influence the original ideals degenerated into hate-filled dogma as each maneuvered to gain control of the dying Ottoman Empire. The 20th century. Chaos in the Middle East. Zionism, Arab nationalism, the Ottomans' decline, and the British ascent. All these elements stewing in a huge cauldron were bound to boil over. Theodor Herzl's comet streaked over the sky with blinding light and speed. It was a mere 10 years from the day he had heard Alfred Dreyfus cry, "I am innocent," to the day he dropped dead of a heart attack at the age of 44. Chapter 7. By the time the Zionist movement came into being, The Rabinsky brothers were old-timers in Palestine. They knew almost every corner of the land and had worked at almost every job. They had lost most of their illusions. Yakov was restless and bitter. Yossi tried to find a measure of contentment in his existence. He appreciated his relative freedom. Moreover, he never stopped dreaming of the land in the Hula Valley above Sfat. Yakov held both the Arabs and Turks in contempt. He looked upon them as enemies, as he had looked upon the Cossacks and students of the gymnasium. It was quite true that the Turks would not tolerate murder, but everything else against the Jews seemed justified. Many a night, Yakov and Yossi sat up arguing.
Certainly we should obtain land through legal purchase, but where are we going to get farmers, and what is going to make the Bedouins and Turks leave us alone?
We will get farmers when the pogroms get bad enough again, Yossi answered. As for the Turks, you can buy them. As for the Arabs, we must learn to live side by side with them in peace. This will happen only if we understand them.
Yakov shrugged.
One thing an Arab understands.
And he held up his fist and shook it.
He understands this.
Someday they will hang you on the gallows, Yossi said.
The brothers grew further and further apart. Yossi maintained his desire for peace and understanding, and Yakov continued to be a proponent of direct action to counter the injustices against the Jews. At the beginning of the new century, Yakov joined a group of 15 men who set out on a daring venture. One of the philanthropic funds purchased a small piece of land deep in the Israel Valley, where no Jews had penetrated for centuries. Here the 15 pioneers established an agricultural training center and experimental farm. The place was called Stetov, Field of Goodness. Their position was extremely dangerous, for they were locked in on four sides by Arab villages and at the mercy of Bedouin tribes who would not hesitate to murder for anything of value. By 1900, there were 50,000 Jews in Palestine and a bit more social life for Yossi. Most of those who fled the pogroms wanted nothing to do with the floundering agricultural colonies, but were content to become merchants or tradesmen in Jaffa. A few of them settled in the tiny port town of Haifa. However, there were too many coming in for all of them to be absorbed as merchants, and there were too many who owned just the clothes they wore. Soon there was a good deal of talk of land redemption. The Zionists opened their first land-buying office, the Zion Colonizing Society, in a dingy, run-down hotel in Jaffa, which was the local headquarters for Jewish itinerants. Rothschild's Palestine Investment Corporation and the De Schumann Foundation also stepped up land-buying operations to open new villages for the returnees. In the middle of 1902, the De Schumann Foundation contacted Yossi Rabinsky and offered him a job as their chief buyer of land. He knew the country as well as any Jew and was noted for his courage in going into Arab territory. Further, he was wise enough to deal with the Turks, for land buying by Jews was severely restricted. Also, one had to be shrewd to trade with the Arab effendis or landowners. Yossi had his doubts about the new colonies. Living by means of philanthropy and using the fellaheen labor did not seem to him to be the way to redeem the promised land, but the opportunity of obtaining land for Jews made him decide to accept the job. There were other motives behind Yossi's decision. He could get to see Yakov more often this way. He could also learn every inch of the land. Yossi never tired of steeping himself in past glories, and every bit of Palestine held another ghost of the former Jewish greatness. Finally, Yossi wanted to be able to travel beyond Rosh Pina, the last Jewish settlement, to see again the land of the Hula near Abu Yesha. Yossi was indeed a handsome figure on his white Arabian stallion. He was a man of 30 now, tall, lean, and muscular. His fiery beard set off the white robes and Arab headdress he was wearing. There were bandoliers of bullets across his shoulders and a bullwhip at his side as he rode deep up into the hills of Samaria and through the plains of Sharon, and into the Galilee, to search out land. Most of the land throughout Palestine was owned by a few dozen powerful Effendi families. They charged the fellaheen rent amounting to from half to three-quarters of all their crops, and they did absolutely nothing for these poor, miserable souls. Yossi and buyers from the other foundations could obtain land only at outrageous prices. The Effendis sold the worst properties, unproductive swamps, to the Jews. They did not believe that anything could or would ever be done with this land, and at the same time, the Hebrew gold was a windfall. Yossi took many trips beyond the last Jewish settlement of Rosh Pina, often to visit Kamal, the Mukhtar of Abu Yeshah. The two men became friends. Kamal was a few years older than Yossi, and a rarity among the Effendis. Most of the Effendis lived as absentee landlords in pleasure spots such as Beirut and Cairo. This was not so with Kamal. He owned all the land in and around Abu Yeshah, and he was absolute monarch within its boundaries. As a youth, he had had a tragic love affair with the daughter of a poverty-stricken fellah. His father had ignored his pleas to provide medical care for the girl. She was suffering from trachoma. Kamal's father reasoned that his son could have four wives and innumerable concubines, so why trouble himself with one miserable fellah woman? The girl went blind of the dread disease and died before her 18th birthday. This event made Kamal a hater of his own class. It cut a scar so deep in his heart that he developed a social conscience. He went off to Cairo, not to enjoy its wild pleasures, but to study advanced farming methods, sanitation, and medicine. When his father died, he returned to Abu Yeshah, determined to live among his people and to better their wretched conditions. Kamal fought a losing battle. The Turks would not give him a school or medical facilities or any social services. Conditions in the village were just about as they had been 1,000 years before. Most heartbreaking for the Arab was the fact that he was unable to translate what he had learned into practical applications for his villagers. They were so illiterate and so backward that they simply could not comprehend. Since he had become Mukhtar, Abu Yeshah had fared better than any Arab village in the Galilee, but conditions there were still primitive. Kamal was puzzled by the strange coming of the Jews to Palestine. Because he wanted to learn its meaning, he intentionally cultivated the friendship of Yossi Rabinsky. Yossi tried to get Kamal to sell him a parcel of land which was not being worked to begin a colony, but Kamal balked. These Jews confused him. He did not know whether they could be trusted or not, for certainly they were not all like Yossi Rabinsky. Besides, he was not going to be the first Effendi to sell land in the Hula Valley. Just as Kamal learned from Yossi, so Yossi learned from Kamal. Despite Kamal's enlightenment, he was heart and soul an Arab. He never spoke of his three wives, for the servitude of woman was traditional. Kamal was always polite, but he was a great man to bicker when bartering. Yossi watched him exercising his authority. Although he had compassion for his people, he could not comprehend any means of rule that was not absolute. On occasion, Kamal even consulted Yossi in some typical double-dealing scheme, which seemed perfectly legitimate to the Arab. Through Kamal, Yossi Rabinsky learned about the magnificent and tragic history of the Arab people. In the 7th century, the dogma of Islam had erupted upon the wild, semi-civilized Bedouin tribes in the deserts. Inspired by Muhammad's divine teachings, they swept out of the sand and with fire and sword spread their gospel from the doorsteps of China to the gates of Paris. During 100 years of holy persuasion, hundreds of millions of the world's peoples had gathered to the banner of Islam. The heart and soul of Islam were the Arabs, who were bound together by a common language and a common religion of submission to God's will. During the meteoric rise of Islam, Jews held the highest positions of esteem in the Arab-speaking world. A magnificent civilization arose from the deserts. It was the light of all mankind while the Western world wallowed in the morass of the Dark Ages and feudalism. Baghdad and Damascus became the Athens of their day. The Muslim culture was dazzling. For 500 years, the most advanced thinking, the greatest scientific efforts, the most magnificent artisans belonged to the Arab-speaking world. Then came the holy wars of the Crusaders, who sacked and raped and killed in the name of the very same God who was shared by Muslim and Christian. After the Crusaders came a century, 100 unrelieved years, of Mongol invasions. The Mongols swooped in from Asia, and the wars were so cruel and so bloody that they defied any known bounds of brutality. Pyramids of Arab skulls stood as the monuments of the Mongols. The Arabs so exhausted themselves in 10 decades of fighting that their once mighty cities were decimated, and a dry rot fell on the flowering oases. The beautiful islands of fruit and plenty were eaten up by seas of sand and erosion. The Arabs turned more and more against themselves, and a bitter and desperate struggle ensued, in which blood feuds pitted brother against brother. Divided against themselves, their land ruined, and their culture all but destroyed, they were unprepared to defend themselves against the final disaster. This time, it was brought about by fellow Muslims as the mighty Ottomans gobbled up their lands. 5 centuries of corruption and feudalism followed. A drop of water became more precious than gold or spices in the unfertile land. The merest, most meager existence was a series of tortured, heartbreaking struggles from birth to death. Without water, the Arab world disintegrated into filth. Unspeakable disease, illiteracy, and poverty were universal. There was little song or laughter or joy in Arab life. It was a constant struggle to survive. In this atmosphere, cunning, treachery, murder, feuds, and jealousies became a way of life. The cruel realities that had gone into forming the Arab character puzzled outsiders. Cruelty from brother to brother was common. In parts of the Arab world, thousands of slaves were kept, and punishment for a thief was amputation of a hand, for a prostitute, amputation of ears and nose. There was little compassion from Arab to Arab. The fellaheen, who lived in abysmal filth, and the Bedouin, whose survival was a day-to-day miracle, turned to the one means of alleviating their misery. They became Muslim fanatics, as elements of the Jews had become fanatics in their hour of distress. It was small wonder that the Arabs mistrusted all outsiders. The restless movement for freedom originated with the ruling classes, for the Bedouins and fellaheen were far too demoralized even to comprehend freedom and better conditions. The masses were but pawns in the schemes of the effendis and sheikhs. They could be stirred into religious hysteria at the least provocation, and were thus useful as a political weapon. Yossi Rabinsky became fascinated by the many-sided Arab character. He could stand for hours around the shops in Jaffa and watch the endless bickering and boisterous trading. He observed as the Arab ran his life as though it were a game of chess. Every move was made with an astuteness designed to outfox those he was dealing with. In the cafes and dens, Yossi watched violent passions erupt. During his land-buying expeditions, he observed the unscrupulous ethics of the Arab. Yet he enjoyed entering an Arab home where hospitality was unsurpassed. He was confounded by the fantastic reasoning that condoned every crime short of murder. He thought the position of women intolerable. They were held in absolute bondage, never seen, never heard, never consulted. Women often sought quick and vicious revenge by dagger or poison. Greed and lust, hatred and cunning, shrewdness and violence, friendliness and warmth, were all part of that fantastic brew that made the Arab character such an enormous mystery to an outsider. Kamal introduced Yossi Rabinsky to the Quran, the holy book of Islam. Yossi learned that Abraham was the father of the Arabs as well as of the Jews. From Ishmael, the cast-out son of Hagar, came the seed of the Arabs. Yossi learned that Moses, the Jews' great lawgiver, was also the chief prophet of the Muslims, and that all of the prophets of the Bible were also prophets of the Quran. Even many of the great rabbis were looked upon as holy men in Islam. Kamal eyed the return of the Jews to the Promised Land with suspicion. The Jews puzzled him, for they had come in peace, purchased their land legally, and spoke only in lofty terms of redemption. Kamal, in understanding the basic drive behind the return, admitted to himself that it was a just and true move. But yet his mind could not believe that the newcomers would not eventually engulf and exploit the Arabs as all the others before them had done. Yaakov left Stetof. The experimental farm had not been a success. In much the same state he had been in before, Yaakov continued to wander around from one end of the country to the other, trying to find his niche. In the year 1905, the revolution long brewing in Russia took place. It was crushed. The failure of the 1905 revolution was a signal for new pogroms. These were so fearful that the entire civilized world stood aghast. Leo Tolstoy was so moved that he wrote a blistering condemnation of the Tsar, his Minister of the Interior, Count Plev, and of the Black Hundreds, whose specialty was murdering Jews. The Black Hundreds, protected by the Russian secret police, continued the pogroms until hundreds of thousands of Jews poured out of Russia. Most of them fled to America. Some went to Palestine. Those who came to the Promised Land were of a new breed. They were not refugees like the Rabinsky brothers, nor were they of a mind to become merchants. These were youngsters indoctrinated in Zionism and filled with idealism and a determination to redeem the land. The year 1905 ushered in the second Aliyah of the Exodus. Chapter 8. The need for idealism in Palestine was satisfied by the coming of the second Aliyah. These newcomers were not content to be merchants in Jaffa, nor did they wish to live off the alms of co-religionists. They were fired with a mission to redeem the land. They set out in groups for the land the Effendis had sold and tried to dry up the swamps. It was terrible work. To many of the old-timers, the thought of Jews laboring in the fields like Arabs was unbelievable. In Palestine, they had been the overseers. In the old country, they did not work the land at all. Of all the gifts the second Aliyah brought with them, the greatest, perhaps, was the pronouncement of self-labor and the conquest of labor. Through their chief spokesman, A.D. Gordon, labor was made something dignified. Gordon was an older man and a scholar, but he gave up scholarship for the greater task of working the soil with his own hands. These were stimulating days for Yaakov. He went out to another new experimental farm in the Galilee called Sejera. In Sejera, the excitement never died as the young Jews of the second Aliyah got down to work. One day Yaakov came into Jaffa to see Yossi, and he was filled with excitement over a new idea. Yaakov spoke with that fiery exuberance that was his own.
"As you know, the Bedouin tribes use extortion to get our settlements to hire them as guards, against themselves. Well, they tried it at Sejera. They came in and made threats of what they'd do unless we hired them. And we didn't. And we've defended ourselves very well. It was precarious for a while, but we set a trap and killed their leader, and they haven't come back since." "We have talked it over," Yaakov continued. "If we can defend one settlement, we can defend them all. We have made plans to form a roving guard, and we want you to take over one of the units."
A Jewish guard? What an astonishing idea. Yossi was excited, but he answered in his usual way.
"I will have to think it over." "What is there to think over?"
You are making it too black and white, as usual, Yakov. First of all, the Bedouins are not going to give up this important source of income without a fight. Then there are the Turks. They will make it nearly impossible for us to carry arms.
I'll be blunt, Yakov said. We wanted you, Yossi, because no one knows the country better, and no one has had more experience in dealing with both Arabs and Turks.
Oh, Yossi mocked. So, all of a sudden, my dear brother realizes that my years of friendship with the Arabs hasn't been a complete waste of time.
What do you say, Yossi?
I say I'll consider it. Our own farmers may need a lot of convincing to let us guard them. And one thing that really annoys me. If we carry loaded guns, it may be interpreted to mean we are looking for a fight. Yakov threw up his hands.
Challenging a fight by defending your own property? After 20 years in Palestine, you still think like a ghetto Jew.
Yossi refused to be rattled. We came in peace. We have purchased our land legally. We have built our settlements without disturbing anyone. Now, if we start to arm, it will be a compromise with the basic idealism of Zionism, and don't pretend there is no risk in that.
But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it, and the Lord wrought a great victory.
Still quoting,
you make me sick,
Yakov snapped.
Sure, Yossi, redeem the land under the magnanimous protection of the Bedouin cutthroats. Very well, I shall tell them my brother is deep in meditation. With or without you, the guardsmen are forming. The unit we want you to command is leaving next week for our base camp.
Where?
On Mount Canaan.
Mount Canaan? Yossi's heart skipped a beat. He wetted his lips and tried to conceal his excitement.
I will think it over, he said.
Yossi did think it over. He was tired of buying land for the Deschumann Foundation and of establishing more colonies to live on charity. A dozen armed Jews who were as hot-headed as Yakov could cause a great deal of trouble. Restraint and wisdom were needed in an armed guard. But the thought of living around Mount Canaan, with the chance to spend time in the Hula Valley, proved too great a temptation. Yossi resigned from the Deschumann Foundation and joined the new group as they arrived at Mount Canaan. They called themselves Chashomer, the guardsmen. Yossi's company was to work in a circle from Mount Canaan. From Rosh Pinah in the north to the Ginesar Valley along the Sea of Galilee in the south, and west to Tzfat and Meron. Yossi knew that it would be only a matter of time until trouble broke out. As soon as the Bedouins learned they had lost their jobs, they were certain to strike. He concocted a plan designed to avert trouble. The most troublesome of the Bedouin tribes in the area was led by an old renegade and smuggler named Suleiman, whose encampments were generally in the hills above Abu Yasha. Suleiman extorted 1/4 of Rosh Pinah's crops in return for protection. The day after his arrival, before the Arabs were aware of the presence of the guardsmen, Yossi rode out alone and unarmed to find Suleiman's camp. He located it late in the evening beyond Abu Yasha, near Tel Hai, on the Lebanon side. The camp consisted of goatskin tents scattered about the browned-out hills. These eternal nomads considered themselves the purest and freest of all Arabs. They looked down contemptuously at the lowly fellahin and the city dwellers. Life was indeed hard for the Bedouin, but he was a free man, with strong tribal ties, fiercest of the Arab fighters and the most cunning of the Arab traders. The sight of the giant red-bearded stranger caused a general alarm. The women, dressed in black Bedouin robes with chains of coins forming masks over their faces, hastened for cover as Yossi rode in. When he had ridden halfway through the camp, a Negro Arab, obviously from the Sudan, came toward him. The Negro introduced himself as Suleiman's personal slave and led him to the largest of the tents near the largest flock of goats. The old brigand stepped outside his tent. The Arab wore black robes and black headdress. Two magnificent silver daggers hung from his waist. He was blind in one eye, and his face was scarred from many battles with men armed with knives and women armed with claws. Suleiman and Yossi sized each other up quickly. Yossi was ushered into the tent. The earthen floor was covered with rugs and cushions. The two men made themselves comfortable. Suleiman ordered his slave to bring fruit and coffee to the guest. The two men smoked from a long-stemmed water pipe and exchanged meaningless amenities for half an hour. Dishes of curried rice and lamb's testicles were served, and they had melons for dessert as they maneuvered the conversation for another hour. Suleiman realized Yossi was no ordinary Jew and on no ordinary mission. At last, he asked Yossi the purpose of his visit, and Yossi informed him that Hashomer was taking up his guarding duties. He thanked Suleiman for his past loyal services. The Arab received the news without batting his good eye. Yossi requested a handshake upon a pact of friendship. Suleiman smiled and offered his hand. Late that night, Yossi rode into Rosh Pinah and called a meeting of farmers. Everyone was terrified by the whole idea of the guardsmen. They were certain that Suleiman would slit their throats when he heard about it. The appearance of Yossi Rabinsky and his promise to remain at Rosh Pinah did much to calm them down. In the rear of the meeting room, a new girl of 20 watched and listened to Yossi Rabinsky. She had only arrived from Silesia in Poland a short time before. Her name was Sarah. She was as tiny as Yossi was huge, and her hair was as black as his was red. She was absolutely entranced as she watched him and listened to him talk. "You are new here," he said after the meeting.
"Yes."
"I am Yossi Rabinsky."
"Everyone knows of you."
Yossi remained at Rosh Pinah for a week. He was certain that Suleiman would make a call, but he knew the Bedouin was crafty enough not to be reckless. Yossi was in no hurry for the Arab to come, because he was greatly taken by Sarah. But in her presence he became tongue-tied and shy, for he had had little or no experience with Jewish girls in his adult life. The more Sarah teased and prodded, the more he turned into a shell. Everyone in Rosh Pinah, except Yossi, knew that he was a marked man. On the ninth day, a dozen Arabs slipped into Rosh Pinah in the middle of the night and made off with several hundred pounds of grain. Yossi was standing guard and saw them coming and observed every move they made. He could easily have caught them red-handed, but it was no crime to catch a Bedouin stealing. Yossi had a different strategy in mind. The next morning, Yossi rode off once more for Suleiman's camp. This time he was armed, with his 10-foot bullwhip. He galloped into the camp at full speed and made directly for Suleiman's tent and dismounted. The Sudanese slave came out and smiled sweetly and welcomed Yossi and invited him to enter. Yossi hit the slave with the back of his hand as though he were flicking a fly from his arm and sent him sprawling to the ground.
"Suleiman!" His big voice boomed out for the whole camp to hear. "Step outside!"
A dozen kinsmen appeared from nowhere with rifles in their hands and surprise on their faces.
"Outside!"
Yossi roared again. The old brigand took a long time to make his appearance. He stepped from the tent and put his hands on his hips and smiled menacingly. 10 feet of ground separated the two.
"Who is it who howls outside my tent like a sick goat?"
Suleiman asked. The tribesmen were seized by a fit of laughter. Yossi did not take his eyes off the Arab for a second.
"It is Yossi Rabinsky who howls like a sick goat," he said, "and says that Suleiman is a thief and a liar."
The smile on Suleiman's lips turned into an ugly scowl. The Bedouins tensed and waited for the signal to pounce on the Jew and devour him.
"Go on," Yossi challenged softly. "Call all your nephews. Your honor is no greater than a pig's
and I hear you have no more courage than a woman. No more courage than a woman. This was the deadliest insult he could hear. Yossi had issued him a personal challenge. Suleiman raised his fist and shook it. Your mother is the biggest whore in the world.
Go on, woman. Keep talking,
Yossi answered. Suleiman's very honor was at stake. He drew one of his silver daggers and with a blood-curdling shriek charged at the red-bearded giant. Yossi's bullwhip whistled out. It wrapped around the Arab's feet, picked him up, and sent him smashing to the earth. Yossi was at him like a cat. He brought the whip down on Suleiman's back with such terrifying speed and strength that the snap echoed through all the hills.
We are brothers! We are brothers!
Suleiman cried for mercy at the end of five lashes. Yossi pointed at his frantic foe.
Suleiman, you gave me your hand in a bargain of honor, and you lied. If you or your kinsmen ever again set foot in our fields, I will cut your body apart with this whip and feed the pieces to the jackals.
Yossi turned, and his eyes pierced the astonished Bedouins. They were all too stunned to move. Never had they seen a man so powerful and fearless and angry. Showing utter disdain for their rifles, Yossi turned his back on them, walked to his horse, mounted, and rode off. Suleiman never touched a Jewish field again. The next morning, when Yossi mounted up to rejoin his company at Mount Canaan, Sarah asked when he would be back. He mumbled something about getting to Rosh Pinah each month or so. As he swung onto his horse, saluted, and galloped off, Sarah thought her heart would burst apart. There was never a man like Yossi Rabinsky, Jew, Arab, Cossack, or king. She swore as she saw him ride away that she would dedicate the rest of her life to loving him. For a year, Yossi commanded his guardsmen company in their territory with such skill that little or no trouble occurred. He never had to resort to firearms. When there was trouble, he would go to the Arabs for a friendly consultation and warning. If it happened again, the bullwhip. The bullwhip of Yossi Rabinsky became as well known through the northern Galilee as his red beard. The Arabs called it lightning. All this proved too dull for Yaakov. He was bored with the lack of action. After 6 months in the guardsmen, he left again to go on the prowl, hoping somehow to fill the constant void in his life. Yossi was neither sad nor happy as a guardsman. It gave him more pleasure than buying land, and it established an important principle by demonstrating that the Jews could and would defend themselves and were no longer children of death. He looked forward to his northern swing so that he could have a visit with his friend Kamal and then travel up to his hill to keep his dream alive. Secretly, he eagerly anticipated those moments when he rode into Rosh Pinah. He would straighten up to look even more elegant and gallant on his white steed, and his heart would beat more quickly, for he knew that Sarah, the dark-eyed girl from Silesia, was watching. But when it came to conversation, or action, Yossi was lost. Sarah was perplexed. She simply could not break down Yossi's shyness. If it had been the old country, the matchmaker would have gone to Yossi's father and arranged everything. Here there was not only no matchmaker, but not even a rabbi. This went on for a year. One day, Yossi rode into Rosh Pinah unexpectedly. It was all he could do to ask Sarah if she would like to ride with him to see the country north of the settlement in the Hula Valley. How thrilling! No Jew but Yossi Rabinsky dared wander up that far. They galloped past Abu Yesha, on up the road, and then into the hills. The trail ended atop his hill.
I crossed into Palestine right here, he said softly.
As Yossi looked down into the Hula Valley, he did not need to say another word. Sarah knew how deeply he loved this earth. The two of them stood and gazed for ever so long.
Sarah barely reached his chest. A warm flood of love passed through her. This was Yossi's only way of sharing his most intimate longing.
Yossi Rabinsky,
Sarah whispered,
would you please, please marry me?
Yossi cleared his throat and stammered,
how strange of you to mention it. I was about to say something of the sort myself.
There had never been a wedding in Palestine to compare with Yossi's and Sarah's. They came from all over the Galilee and even from as far away as Jaffa, even though it was a two-day journey to Sfat. The guardsmen came, and Yaakov came, and the settlers of Rosh Pina came, and Turks came, and Kamal came, and even Suleiman came. Everyone watched as Yossi and Sarah stood beneath the canopy and exchanged vows and drank the blessed wine. Yossi crushed the wine glass beneath his foot in remembrance of the bitterness of the fall of the temple. There was food enough for an army, and there was dancing and gaiety and celebration that lasted nearly a week. When the last guest had gone home, Yossi took his bride to his tent on the side of Mount Canaan and consummated their marriage. Yossi took his bride down from Mount Canaan to Jaffa, where there was much work to be done for the Zionists. His fame left him well equipped to take charge of settling newcomers and to deal with the many intricacies of this strange land. He signed on with the Zionists as one of the chief men in the Zion Settlement Society. In the year 1909, Yossi was consulted in a very important matter. Many of the Jews of Jaffa's growing community wanted better housing, sanitation, and a cultural life that the ancient Arab city could not offer. Yossi was instrumental in purchasing a strip of land north of Jaffa, which consisted mostly of sand and orange groves. On this land, the first all-Jewish city in 2,000 years was built. They called it